You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Saddam Hussein was deposed in the spring of 2003, a few months after U.S. forces entered Iraq. For Ahmad Chalabi, this event was the realization of a dream he'd held for over 40 years. He'd made his first coup attempt when he was just 19 years old, but he was in exile when he finally found his ultimate partner in revolution, the administration of George W. Bush. According to journalist and five-time Emmy Award-winning 60 Minutes producer Richard Bonin, There has never been a foreigner more crucially involved in a decision by the United States to go to war than Chalabi. And in his new book from Doubleday, Arrows of the Night, Ahmad Chalabi's Long Journey to Triumph in Iraq, Mr. Bonin calls Chalabi either the great liberator of Iraq or the great seducer of America. I'm very pleased to welcome Richard Bonin to our show. Hi.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for having me.
So where and when did you first meet Ahmad Chalabi?
Well, I met Ahmad Chalabi for the first time in London shortly after the attacks of 9/11. And I knew he was a leading opposition figure, but nobody knew whether or not to take him too seriously. And I was sitting in his offices there in Knightsbridge, and calls were coming in left and right from some of the leading members of the administration and the neoconservative movement, and I realized that this guy was to be taken seriously.
But wasn't he under a cloud? Because in 1992, Mr. Chalabi had been tried in his absence and sentenced to 22 years in jail by a Jordanian court.
He was. He was convicted of bank fraud in Jordan, and the CIA considered that not a problem, but an asset. They wanted to organize a covert operation to overthrow Saddam, and they thought a convicted bank swindler would be the perfect cover for laundering the movement of millions of dollars around the world. Everyone would think, oh, Chalabi's got $200 million in cash. Of course he's paying for this himself. It can't be the CIA.
So what was he doing at the time when you met him?
Well, he was heading up the Iraqi National Congress, which was originally the CIA-organized political opposition group, dedicated to overthrowing Saddam. And originally it was a CIA cover to promote support in Europe for overthrowing Saddam, and Chalabi was going to be their asset. But as he told me, the CIA was going to be my asset, and he quickly hijacked the operation.
After your meeting with him, you immediately called Leslie Stahl and proposed a 60-minute segment on him. Was that because of a particular impression he made on you during that meeting? Or did you just think, well, this is a man who is going to be really important?
Well, because there was a lot of talk at the time that President Bush might want overthrow Saddam, invade Iraq, and not many people took it seriously at the time, believe it or not. And here I was sitting in his office in London, and he had Saddam's order of battle stretched out on his desk. He was talking to Iraqis left and right. And all of these calls were coming in from Washington, from leading neoconservatives inside the Bush administration. And our bosses in New York were skeptical. Governor from Texas, who's now the president, would never hook up with Ahmad Chalabi. And I'm sitting there, well, you know what? They already have.
Hey, you wound up, or Leslie wound up talking with him over the course of 10 years.
Yeah, we did our first story with him in 2002, I guess.
And, so before the invasion?
Yes. Actually, I think it was 2001. Yeah, and we did a story, and it was basically a profile of Chalabi. And as I said at the time, it's sort of like the inverse of John Lennon. John Lennon wanted to give peace a chance. Chalabi wanted to give war a chance. And he was campaigning for the U.S. to invade Iraq.
And you describe him as seductive. Did he seduce other reporters as well? I mean, Judith Miller's relationship with him has become quite well known.
He seduced a lot of us. I mean, he is the most charming, engaging man I've ever met, and he's brilliant. He got a degree in mathematics from the MIT, a PhD in mathematics from the University of Chicago. He knows more about...
So he's American educated.
Yeah, Western, and he knows more about the American Civil War than most of us Americans do. He could talk about anything, and he's fun, he's charming, he's engaging, and it's great to be with him.
You write that he has been steeped in a world of political uprising since he grew up in Iraq. Is that because his family was exiled while he was still very young?
Well, it was before that, actually. His father was the single wealthiest man in Iraq in the old monarchy up until 1958, and he parlayed his economic power into political influence, and he was very close to the king of Iraq, very close to the government structure in Iraq. And in those days, politics in Iraq was a very personal business. You conducted politics one-on-one, over tea, in your living room, and Ahmed Chalabi's father gave his son a ringside seat, and Ahmed just sit there and watched his father cement alliances, crush opponents, and scheme for the old Iraq and until the government was overthrown.
His father's name was Abdul Hadl?
Yes.
I don't know how last names change like that, but he was also a Shiite in a country where that was a disadvantage, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was an interesting paradox. I mean, it's a Sunni-controlled country, Sunni-run country. The Sunnis were a minority. The Shias were the majority. And the family managed to overcome the prejudice and hostility towards Shias and rise to the top of the economic and political structure. But they never forgot that there was a glass ceiling, and there was a resentment toward the Sunni minority-controlled government that he grew up with.
Especially when it came to the military.
Yes.
There was discrimination against Shiites in the military, so they felt that that would always keep the Shiites down.
Right. Politically, the Shiites, and economically, began to acquire positions of status in old Iraq, everywhere except in the military. The people with the guns were Sunni.
But when revolution finally did come in 1958, it was largely over social reform, wasn't it?
Yes, and political. I mean, there was Nasserism, Arab nationalism that was sweeping the region. But also, I think something like 3% of the Iraqi population controlled 70% of the wealth. And Ahmed Chalabi's father was the incarnation of that inequity. The Chalabis saw it through the lens of the Shia persecution, that the military resented the nascent rise of the Shias, and that's how they viewed the revolution, and that is what propelled Chalabi from that point forward.
And did he continue to hold that belief that they had been victims of their religion rather than the fact that they were seen as, they were the wealthiest family in a country where 50% of the people didn't have running water?
Yeah. I mean, I think intellectually he understood the socioeconomic inequity, but in his heart of hearts, he felt the Shia prejudice was the issue.
My guest is Richard Bonin, who's written a book called Arrows of the Night, Ahmed Chalabi's Long Journey to Triumph in Iraq. It's published by Doubleday, although we'll find out whether it's total triumph or not later. The family escaped to London.
Yes.
It was a culture shock for them, wasn't it?
It was. When Chalabi was growing up in Baghdad, his father was surrounded by bodyguards, tea boys, manservants. They didn't do anything for themselves. And all of a sudden, their family is turned upside down. They've lost their fortune. They've lost their vast real estate holdings. And now they're in a little apartment in London with white walls and raggedy furniture. And Ahmed, for the first time, sees his father cooking rice. And it is an epiphany for Ahmed that his life has changed and everything is different.
But they're already plotting to return.
From day one.
And what did they hope they were going to be able to do?
It was their Shangri-La. They wanted to go back. They wanted to turn the clock back and restore the monarchy and restore their position.
Was he able to go back any time before the invasion in 2003?
At one point, father went back in the 1960s thinking there might be an opening, and it was very short-lived. As soon as he returned, he realized there was no constituency for him, and he was forced to leave again.
Well, he believed that the reason for the Shiites' lack of influence in Iraq was inadequate education, particularly in modernity and in understanding the ways of the West. So I'm assuming that's why Ahmed wound up going to American universities.
Yes. I mean, Ahmed is a brilliant person. He would have been brilliant anyway. But now he pursued education and enlightenment with a purpose. And it was no longer just to feed his natural curiosity, but to make history, to make himself a man of history.
Well, did he reveal to you what he had done to get out of having to do his chores in school? This elaborate bribery system he came up with?
Yes.
He was proud of this?
Yes. When he was in boarding school, he hated eating at the cafeteria with all of his classmates. He hated the food that they served at the cafeteria. So he came up with a scheme, and his parents would send in food for him, cans of fruit and bread, freshly baked bread, and everything like that. And what he would do is he would bribe a proprietor who gave the upperclassmen cigarettes, and the upperclassmen in turn would look the other way and allow Ahmed and his friends to stay back in the dormitory and eat rather than going to the cafeteria.
So he went
from early on, yes, he was a master manipulator.
And you say that he was, he studied mathematics, was brilliant at it, but he also did a lot of other reading in American history. Did he read fiction? Was he... Was he reading Machiavelli?
If he wasn't reading Machiavelli, it came naturally to him. He was reading Dostoevsky, but he read a lot of history. And he used to, when he was at MIT, he said he found mathematics easy. He had a lot of spare time in his hands, and he used to roam the stacks at the university library. And he would read how the Germans supported Lenin. So Lenin could get back to Russia and overthrow the monarch, and he put together models in his head.
And at 19, he participated in a coup attempt.
His first coup attempt, yes.
So this is while he's going to school in America.
Yes, exactly, on summer break.
What was going on?
I went to Disneyland on my summer break. He went to overthrow.
What was going on in Iraq at the time that motivated him to get involved?
Well, the Ba'athists had just taken over for the first time, and they were, as we all know, particularly brutal. And his older brothers, who were 9, 10 years older than him, were much more involved in the coup attempt, and they were trying to midwife a revolution with some Shia soldiers. And Ahmed came to the middle, went from Boston to Beirut and then to Jordan, and he was helping organize generals and secret meetings and disseminating information and working the press.
And did they get any help from the outside, or was this just an internal
coup? It was an internal thing.
It didn't do very well.
Didn't do very well. It ended in disaster, and scores of Iraqi officers were killed.
And then there was a second coup attempt that he was involved with, which began in 1969, just after he received his graduate diploma. Was that when he began his relationship with Iran?
That was the first time, yeah. He got his diploma. His mother told him, don't get involved. It's too dangerous. But he went to Tehran, and he met with the head of the Shah's secret intelligence service, Savak. He met with senior Kurdish leaders, and they slipped into northern Iraq, Kurdistan, and plotted.
And that didn't hurt him later, after the fall of the Shah, when he went back to Iran?
No, when he went back to Iran, his bigger problem was his previous association with the CIA. The Islamic radicals in Iran weren't sure if he was just a stalking horse for the great Satan or a true Iraqi patriot.
My guest is Richard Bonin, who is a producer at CBS's 60 Minutes. He works with Leslie Stahl. He's won 5 Emmys for his work, as well as an Overseas Press Club Award for his reporting in Iraq. And he's written a book called Arrows of the Night, Ahmed Chalabi's Long Journey to Triumph in Iraq, published by Doubleday. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Richard Bonin. His book, Arrows of the Night, Ahmed Chalabi's Long Journey to Triumph in Iraq, published by Doubleday. So he went back to Iran when he was hoping to get support during the U.S.-led Iraq War. Did the people he met around that time help him later on? The Iranian intelligence service, the Kurds?
You mean in the early 2000s?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, his past work, his past coup attempts, one of the cornerstones was that he met the Kurds for the first time and established a lifelong relationship with them. And that was key. And that was central to his vision of overthrowing Saddam and the Ba'athists, which was to organize an enclave in northern Iraq, in Kurdistan, that would be their base of operation and move south to Baghdad.
And there's a lot of fluidity between the Iranian border, the Kurds, and the Iraqi border.
Exactly. You know, where he basically set up in northern Iraq, Sulaymaniyah, is about 50 miles from the Iranian border, and it's a no-man's land. It's very easy to go back and forth.
But then this is also a time when he began to court the press.
Yes.
And the U.S. ambassador in Lebanon. Now, he'd moved to Lebanon after he'd finished his studies?
Yes, it was the first time he lived back in the Middle East after he graduated from the University of Chicago. And he became a university professor, and that lasted for a couple of years, and he was brilliant. He was dazzling as a professor, but the family decided to go into the banking business, and they set up a bank in Amman, Jordan, and he left the university for banking in Amman.
And that led to the so-called Petra affair.
Yes, the Petra Bank scandal. Yeah, when he took over the bank, he started it from the ground up, and by the end of the 1980s, it was the second largest bank in Jordan, and he had revolutionized banking in Jordan. But at the same time, he was involved in some funny business and was ultimately convicted of bank fraud and sentenced to more than 20 years in prison.
And he said that was political, but right. It looks pretty much like he did what he was accused of.
Well, he didn't engage in rank fraud. I mean, sure, he did things that...
Money was being slipped to the family. It was
being
slipped into Iraq.
Money was being slipped to people with power. He lent over $20 million to the crown prince, King Hussein's brother. And he did it to cultivate power, to make himself powerful. But really what got him in trouble was Iran was involved in a war against Iraq at the time. And Chalabi wanted to do anything he could to defeat Saddam. Iran was running out of money. They were running out of food. They were running out of weapons. And he used his family banking business to funnel money to the Iranians to defeat Saddam on the battlefield. And he overextended the family's banking system, and that led to the unraveling of their banks.
Well, so much of this still has to do with the fact that he's Shiite, and he's hoping that the overthrow of Saddam will also lead to the Shiite majority finally being able to rule the country. But didn't that go against the interests of much of the Islamic world, the United States at the time, the UK, the Soviet Union?
Everybody. This was the audacity and the brilliance of his vision. I mean, the Middle East is run by the Sunnis. It was in everybody's interest to keep it that way. The flow of oil to the West, to Japan, all dependent on the Sunni-dominated system. And he decided he needed to break the Sunni hold.
And he felt that he was uniquely qualified to bring about this change?
He felt he was the most successful businessman in the Middle East. He was the most educated and intelligent. The man did not lack for confidence. And you know what? He did have a lot going for him.
But at the same time, the United States was supporting Saddam. It feared a Shia takeover of Iraq by the Iranians or people
by
allied.
By Shia Iraqis who would be more loyal to Iran than to the West, yes.
And yet Chalabi decided that the United States was the key to his revolution.
He did. He went to the United States and decided he would redefine our conception of our national interest.
But at the same time, to further complicating the situation, Chalabi came to the conclusion that in order to achieve his goals, he would have to work with Iran. Did he ever intend for an Iran-U.S. partnership, or did he just plan to play both sides at the same time and not let each know that he was working with the other?
Well, there was only one power who could defeat Saddam, and that was the United States. Politically and militarily, we were the only ones with the clout to do that. But he also knew Iran had enough assets on the ground, because they're there in the neighborhood on the border of Iraq, to thwart a U.S. Action against Saddam. So what he had to do was at least get Iran to accept U.S. meddling in Iraq.
And he decided that the solution was to make Iraq a domestic issue in the United States.
Right.
Did he have any plan as that was going to happen before 9/11 occurred?
Yeah. It's amazing. I mean, when he came to the U.S., he led no army, led no tribe, knew nobody in the U.S., and he decided that he would systematically court the levers of power, the press, the think tanks, members of Congress, and he looked to AIPAC, Israel, and he said, what the American Jews have done is make Israel a domestic political issue. It's not a foreign policy issue.
And that's what happened when Saddam invaded Kuwait.
Well, that broke the bond between the U.S. and Saddam. Prior to that, the U.S. supported Saddam despite his brutality, but once he invaded Kuwait, then Saddam became an equal threat to the Iranians.
Well, do you think that Chalabi would have succeeded if Iraq hadn't invaded Kuwait and if 9/11 hadn't happened?
It's hard to say how he would have handled it, but Chalabi's genius again was to understand the currents of history and capitalize on them. He would watch history unfold and say, this is where I need to put myself to move my agenda forward.
Even though he formed the Iraqi National Congress with the help of the CIA.
Well, he didn't actually. It was the CIA.
But he didn't make himself the leader of the group. Was that a strategic move?
The CIA intended for him to be a mid-level manager of the Iraqi National Congress and to be its asset. And what he did was completely hijack the operation and turn the INC into his instrument, get the CIA to work for him, and to parlay his position at the Iraqi National Congress as a source of his own power and legitimacy.
And did he succeed? And the CIA liked working with him?
No, they hated it. It lasted for 5 or 6 years, and then it ended very badly.
My guest is Richard Bonin, who is a producer at CBS News' 60 Minutes. He's written a book called Arrows of the Night, Ahmed Chalabi's Long Journey to Triumph in Iraq. It's published by Doubleday. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So here we have between 1990 and 2001, Chalabi nurturing a relationship with the press, lecturing in front of prominent U.S. leaders, including the Council on Foreign Relations. What's interesting is that the statements of his that you quote during this time period would later be repeated verbatim by President Bush and other members of his cabinet. Had Chalabi been successful in changing the national tone of foreign policy in regard to Iraq? Or was it just that he had made alliance with the neoconservatives who played a major role in determining policy after Bush came to power?
Well, they were the two sides of the same coin. I mean, they found each other in the mid-1990s, and the neoconservatives wanted to overthrow Saddam, and Chalabi wanted to overthrow Saddam, and they worked together to create a climate of opinion in this country that Saddam was an unacceptable threat.
You begin your book with a meeting on day two of the Bush administration.
It's amazing, right?
What happened?
Well, on January 21st, 2001, Richard Perle, one of the leading neoconservatives, convened a meeting at his house in Chevy Chase, Maryland. And among those attending were Paul Wolfowitz, Doug Feith, Zalmay Khalilzad, and John P. Hanna, all of whom would go on within a few weeks to assume prominent positions in the George W. Bush administration. And the one non-American there was Ahmed Chalabi.
And what was the motivation of these neoconservatives in for igniting a war with Iraq?
Well, philosophically, I mean, they're patriots. They believed it was in America's interest.
But there are a lot of countries that they probably could have pointed to. There was North Korea, Myanmar. We could go on around the world, countries where patriots might think, well, this leadership has to be overthrown.
True. But they felt the threat from the Middle East was unique, and they also, I think, felt Saddam was somewhat low-lying fruit, that that he was particularly easy to pick off.
And you're right
and
about...
And plus, yeah, there was Ahmad Chalabi. There was nobody else in America campaigning to overthrow the regime in North Korea.
And you're right about them planning to preassemble a stack of memos to answer the likely opposing arguments to regime change in Iraq.
Right. Richard Perle, who had been the Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration, Assistant Secretary of Defense, knew that policy decisions were fought out in the trenches of the bureaucracy, and it was winning the argument. And that meant presenting policy papers, and he wanted to answer every argument against overthrowing Saddam before the administration got going.
Chalabi is often described as the Pentagon's favorite candidate for Iraqi leader. Was he? Was that Donald Rumsfeld or the Pentagon?
Below Donald Rumsfeld, he was. Yeah, Donald Rumsfeld was agnostic. I mean, he supported overthrowing Saddam, but not getting behind Ahmad Chalabi. Richard Perle, Paul Wolfowitz, Doug Feith, they were Chalabi's men inside the administration.
And what about President Bush or Vice President Cheney?
Vice President Cheney was on board. I mean, he was not a true believer like Richard Perle, but he had met Chalabi privately one-on-one at the residence of the vice presidency and liked Chalabi and believed that he was somebody that we could work with.
So what ultimately led to Chalabi's downfall?
Well, at the end of the day, President Bush would not tip the scale in favor of Chalabi in terms of selecting him as the leader of post-Saddam Iraq. He felt the Iraqis should decide themselves. And as far as Chalabi was concerned, that broke the covenant between him and the neoconservatives. And once he realized that the Bush administration wasn't going to back him, he then turned increasingly toward Iran.
And that, of course, put a big taint on him. A caller, Jim from Bricktown, New Jersey, asked if Chalabi had any influence on Christopher Hitchens' decision to support the invasion.
Well, Chalabi and Hitchens are very close. Christopher Hitchens is a big supporter of Ahmad Chalabi, and he was a big supporter, understandably, for overthrowing Saddam. I mean, all of us who had ever been to Iraq knew what it was like. I'd been there several times during the Saddam era. We all knew about the gassing of the Kurds. I mean, he was a truly evil dictator. And there was an understandable moral compulsion for wanting to overthrow him. The question is, was Chalabi the answer for replacing him?
Well, it seems that like he and his INC were pretty hard to work with. You include a quote from Paul Wolfowitz that implies that had the CIA and the State Department not found Chalabi so hostile, their focus would have been on liberation of Iraq instead of occupation.
It's true. I mean, from Wolfowitz's point of view, much of the policy debate about Iraq was not how to run Iraq after Saddam was gone, but how to prevent Chalabi from taking over. And Chalabi hovered over all of the internal debates.
What role did Chalabi play in the weapons of mass destruction discussion?
Well, he played a huge role. He procured a bunch of timely defectors who had tales of Saddam's possessions of weapons of mass destruction and ties to al-Qaeda. We now know, of course, Saddam had neither, but at the time, they played a huge role in influencing the press, influencing the public opinion about the threat Saddam posed.
Chalabi is back in Iraq. He lives in Baghdad in a former Ba'athist headquarters. That seems weird.
Yeah. Well, his sister owned a house in Baghdad, in the Mansour district of Baghdad. And after the Ba'athists took over, they seized her house. And then after the U.S. took over, he re-seized the house. So he lives in his sister's house now, old house.
He once aspired to run the country. Does he still have hopes of achieving political prominence?
Without a doubt. I mean, right now he's a member of parliament, one of 325 members. It's not what he hoped for or expected, but he is plotting and conniving every day.
But he's still elected to parliament, which means that there are people who support him?
Barely. I think out of 22 million votes cast, he won 20,000.
Richard Pearl suggests that he would have been a much larger figure in history if we had not had 9/11.
Yeah, as Richard told me in the book, Chalabi made the idea of overthrowing Saddam acceptable, and 9/11 made it more likely that we would overthrow Saddam, but less likely that we would do it with Chalabi, because once 9/11 happened, the uniformed side of the Pentagon took over, the generals at CENTCOM, the CIA took over, the State Department took over, and none of them liked or cared for Chalabi, and they were going to occupy Iraq and not turn it over to any exile.
Do you know if Chalabi has read your book?
He has.
What does he think of it? Is he still talking to you?
I haven't talked to him since he read it. I've spoken to one of his top lieutenants who gave the book to Chalabi, and the lieutenant is not happy with the book.
I am. Richard Bonin's book, Arrows of the Night, Ahmed Chalabi's Long Journey to Triumph in Iraq. And you call it a triumph?
A triumph in that since age 13, he has been thinking and dreaming of going home. And he did it. He got the last superpower on the planet to overthrow Saddam.
It's published by Doubleday. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.